So, welcome. I'm doing a little bit of an experiment here. In a different project, I'm developing an app that lets people react to events in real time. And if you want to try it, please feel free to give it a shot. I figured I'd use myself as a guinea pig. If it gets distracting or it doesn't work, then please dump it and listen to the talk. That's much more interesting, I hope. I'm Philip Resnick. I'm from the University of Maryland, and I'm actually coming to this talk from two different perspectives. One is as a natural language processing researcher in academia, and the second perspective is as somebody who has been working since 1999 on natural language processing of clinical records, up to this point about 250 million of them, increasing by about 1 to 2 million a week. And this talk has essentially an argument to make. And so I'm going to structure this talk around the argument, and hopefully you will come out convinced of two things. One is that the direction, one of the major directions that we're heading in with electronic health records is worrisome. And two, that natural language processing actually has a very important role to play in the solution. So the first step of the argument probably won't be a surprise to many of the people in this room. Electronic health records are a big deal. I'll set the table a little bit by giving a definition and a couple of numbers. So what is an electronic health record? An electronic health record is basically doing the job of keeping track of all of your medical information, all of your health information. That is the goal of these things. That includes your demographic information, it includes your diagnoses over time, the procedures you've had done, your lab test results. Everything about you as a patient, the goal is to capture in these longitudinal, i.e. over time, records, not only for your own healthcare, but also so that you can aggregate it and use that information for things. A big deal. In the U.S., there's on the order of 2 billion doctor-patient encounters. So during the hour that we're here together, there'll be about 200,000 doctor-patient encounters across the country. Back in 2004, there was a goal set of assuring that most Americans would have electronic health records by roughly 2 years from now. In 2009, a significant level of seriousness was reached, with the allocation of a 20 with another lot of zeros after it, to actually trying to make that happen. So people are, in fact, starting to take this very seriously. The healthcare community is looking at issues like meaningful use, because that is their criteria for how they're incentivized to use electronic health records. And everybody's in a bit of a scramble trying to figure out what's going on with these things and what the world should look like once they're introduced. So, why are these things a big deal? Why are they important? And the answer is because they are the way to answer crucial questions we need to answer. Like, if you're a patient, and you're a provider helping a patient, which decision in terms of treatment or other things is the best for this patient, given the conglomeration of evidence that you have? How well does a proposed treatment work across a population? Does drug effectiveness actually vary by patient population? So personalized medicine is something that you can actually move to once you have large quantities of aggregated health information across lots of demographics and once you get people's genomes into the health records. Who are good candidates for a clinical trial? This is a thing people are desperate to figure out. It's archaic how people for clinical trials are located right now. Which caregivers are following the best practices? You know, which emergency room doctors actually gave the patient with the heart trouble aspirin when they came in, and which ones forgot? I can go on here. Are we seeing evidence of a biological attack? That last bullet is actually there because I hate bullets, and I figured I needed to do something to try to make the slide a little bit more interesting. So I don't actually have anything to say about alien invasions. That's in another session. So here's the thing. All of these applications require the ability to look at data that you can count things with. They require that you put the data in some kind of database-y format so you can do things like predictive analytics or counting things up. So if you want to get the benefits of the electronic health record, you need it in a form that analytics and database people are happy with. And of course, the obvious solution to this is to have the people who are creating the documentation in these records put it in a form that all of those people will be happy with. So where does this take place? I want to talk about the traditional way of doing things and that way of doing things. The traditional way of doing things, I've boiled down to a very simple, in fact, oversimplified picture. On the left, you have a doctor. The traditional way to enter information into a record involves both metadata, so, you know, discrete fields, checkboxes, and those sorts of things, but a significant amount of clinical dictation. Person is, the provider is talking about the care of the patient. You know, Mr. Jones is a 68-year-old male who came to me complaining of pain in his left big toe. And the way that the information gets used, one of the key things, is actually the revenue cycle. They're documenting for clinical purposes, but they're also documenting to get paid. And the way they get paid is by translating those clinical records, the dictations, into codes that are what the insurers and Medicare use as the basis for the payment back to the clinicians. That's the arrow going back on the other side. And so the procedures, the diagnoses, the level of service in an evaluation and management setting, in the hospital, you're rolling up a huge amount of information into a very small a packet of information. And that's done traditionally by people. Again, kind of an archaic thing. But people who have a profession of their own, certified professional coder is one of the certifications they can get. You may not have known they existed, but there are lots of them across the country, and they know how to read medical records and turn those things into codes, and they know the rules so that they can do this in a way that people get paid. And this is how the documentation gets created and how information currently is abstracted from it at a very high level. Now, the direction things are headed is to change that model. So the coding tools and services and the rest of that stuff is not the focus. The focus is further upstream. The idea is to get the provider to enter information in an analytics and database-friendly way. How do you do that? Well, you control their vocabulary if they're dictating. You give them pick lists, little pull-down lists, so that instead of saying MI or myocardial infarct or whatever it is, you give them one way and that's an option on the menu. You do a lot of discrete data entry, and then if there are things that leak that don't fit into that paradigm, you give them text boxes somewhere in the record so they can type stuff if they want to, right? So that little teeny picture there at the left, blown up a little bit, that's interesting. It comes up on my screen. It animates in. Okay, so that's just fine. It's an old but somewhat typical example of what an electronic health record looks like. Sorry, let's be clear. The usual terminology is that an electronic medical record is for the encounter. The electronic health record rolls up a lot of those for the longitudinal picture of care. I may slip up and use one when I mean the other. In general, the big issue is electronic health records, but the issue I'm pointing to is centered right in the middle, where the electronic medical records are used to document the particular instances of care. And so there are no text boxes in this particular one, but you get a flavor of the sort of thing. You get the pull-down menus, and you get the check boxes, and you get the places. This is, in fact, the paradigm that has a lot of momentum in healthcare for entering information. And it makes a lot of sense. In a variety of ways. I mean, if you were to, for example, look at all the different ways to say, take one tablet by mouth daily, this is just 40 or so different ways to say it. And in fact, the person that I got this list from had another 960 or so on the list. Something as simple, I mean, something like that, yeah, I mean, okay, that makes sense, right? It's crazy to have those things said in lots of different ways so the database people have to tear their hair out and say, well, wait, I just want to count that thing, and that thing is a unitary concept. But there's a catch. The catch is that this path to electronic health records threatens to disrupt or even do away with the natural use of language in clinical records. The text boxes are there. But if you use them, they fragment up the language, and there's also a strong disincentive to use. I mean, it's extra work to add information. It's a hell of a lot easier just to click. And so you have a lose-lose situation. If it's a disincentive, then people don't use them. And if people do use them, then you've just lost the advantages of the database, because now you have this stuff in plain old language, and you have the one tablet per day problem again. So these things are pushing in a direction that is worrisome. Why? Because they disrupt the natural communication between providers in the way that they were trained to communicate with each other, and the language and clinical records is also a big deal. And I'm going to spend a big chunk of the talk here, roughly the first half, arguing that, and then making two different arguments for that premise. Then I'm going to shift to a possible solution to the problem. So what do I mean by the clinical narrative? The language of clinical dictations creates a story. It creates the story of care for the patient. It's typically expressed in natural language, yes, specialized language. I mean, medicine is, in fact, a rich technical domain. But it unfolds like a story. That's the traditional way that these things go. So you know, just to give you a flavor of this, you know, here's somebody who went into the hospital complaining of shortness of breath and showed up in the emergency room. The stuff I've highlighted in blue is a lot of the things that you would find in your typical record of the other kind. You know, the age, 68 years old, female. The diagnosis, you know, the admitting diagnosis or the, you know, the admitting problem is shortness of breath. Bunches of other things, but there's also here highlighted in red, lots of other stuff that helps tell the story of this patient's encounter in the emergency room. And I want to give some examples of this in the next, well, I actually give one example in the next slide. I have other examples that I can give. I just pulled out one. I consulted with, by the way, I'm not a clinician. I'm not an MD. But I work with some. And so I consulted with one, you know, looking at some of these things to try to find a good example. This was an interesting one. So on May 3rd, this person came in again with shortness of breath. And in the description of what happened in the emergency room, it said this. Blood pressure was brought down aggressively. With this combined with BiPAP, which is sort of a airway treatment, she's reversed her respiratory distress promptly. It's hard to think about putting that into a checkbox, other than, like, yes, BiPAP was used. But he explained to me what was going on here in the story. What was going on here in the story was that the doctors in the emergency room were trying to figure out whether the shortness of breath in this woman was due exclusively to her failing heart or if there was a problem with pneumonia. People who have pneumonia do not react, and here's a key word, promptly to this treatment. The way he said it to me, they don't just hop off the gurney in a half an hour, right? But she responded promptly. This gave them information. This was a part of the big picture of her clinical care. And I'm not like Mitt Romney. I don't have $10,000 to bet. But I'm willing to bet one person at least a beer if they can find a point and click electronic medical record that has a checkbox or even a slider for how quickly the person responded to that to that treatment. So here's another thing from an editorial in a Pennsylvania newspaper. I worry EMRs, as implemented, can actually downgrade the quality of information. Doctors are worried about this. There's this enormous momentum, but people are worried about it. And it turns out, as far as I can tell, nobody's studying this. You can find tons of, go to PubMed, you will find five publications in the last, since the beginning of March, with electronic health record in the title, just in the last month, from all different perspectives. This is in the Journal of Psychiatry, this is in the Journal of Dermatology, I mean, it's all over the place. But what people are doing, they're studying adoption rates, they're studying the cost of these things, economic value, effects of these things on quality of care, all very important things to be studying. As far as I could tell in my digging, you're not finding a lot of people saying, how does this actually affect the quality of clinical information that is being communicated among providers? And so I decided to look at this. Here's how I did it with some other folks. What you'd really like to do is compare the clinically relevant information in a dictation about an encounter, like the thing that happened in the emergency room, with the clinically relevant information in exactly that scenario if it had happened, that information had been entered in this new way. You'd like to do a head-to-head comparison of those things. So the way that we attempted to do this was we took the specification, the spec of an electronic health record. We used actually the spec from, this was a couple of years ago, we couldn't find something that was standard enough in the U.S., so we used the British Columbia one because it was in use and kind of mandated as being in use. We wanted something that seemed reasonably representative, was in use by folks, and learned enough about it, two people, of which I was one, learned enough about it to be able to go through clinical dictations. We took 20 cardiology dictations and went through them manually, effectively highlighting the stuff for which you could find a place for it in one of those discrete kinds of records without having to type into a text box. So that created a set of information. So that's me by the computer there. You got the long hair. And that created these items of information that could be represented in that kind of record. Then what we did was we took two cardiology experts and we gave them the following scenario. We said, let's pretend that this clinical record, and we did this for all 20 notes, pretend that this record is somebody that a doctor across the country has referred to you as a case because they're moving across the country. And the information they sent with the patient is the stuff in blue over there. But the full picture of the patient is the stuff on the left. I want you to go through and extract, identify, you know, do your own yellow highlighter, the stuff on the left that didn't find a place, in other words, for which there was a gap. And I want you to rate how severe that gap is on a 1 to 5 scale, where 1 is, it'd be nice to have, and 5 is, oh my God, it's very, very bad for the care of the patient that they did not communicate this to me. So here's what we did. We were very conservative. We considered something an omission only if both experts independently identified the same thing as an omission. One of them was actually more conservative than the other one. So we went for maximally conservative. We didn't want to... The way you do this in sort of these experimental methods is you try to bias the experiment against yourself. You try against the outcome that you think is going to happen. And so an omission was only an omission if both experts identified it as such. And if one rated it as a 4 in severity of omission and one rated it as a 3, then it was a 3. We took the lower of the two. It'd kind of be maximally conservative. In 10 out of those 20 cardiology records, it's a small N, kind of a pilot study size thing, so I'm not going to make any large N kinds of claims. But in 1 out of 2 of those documents, there was a piece of information, right, that was above a 3, in other words, a 4 or a 5, actually in this particular case, a 4, in severity. In 50% of the records, there was at least one thing that two doctors independently concluded this should have been in this patient's record. And then we said, well, you know what, maybe we're being unfair. Because we looked at the stuff that said was omitted, and some of it, it's like, well, come on, with a little bit of engineering, you could modify the electronic medical record to do this. So, you know, the fact that the patient denies shortness of breath, right, a negated thing, fine, you put a checkbox, you know, and you say a negative report. There was no slot for mild versus level of severity of pain, for example, allergies, you know, I mean, allergic reactions. There was stuff there that they fit into the spirit of the electronic medical record. They just didn't happen to be in this one. Now, this is one that was deployed and in use. But nonetheless, again, be maximally conservative and disregard those. Pretend, give it credit as if that was in there. You still had 1 out of 4, right, where you had a severe problem. So this is an attempt to capture the difference in information communicated with the kinds of electronic medical records for which there is a great deal of momentum now versus traditional clinical dictations. And when you go and look at the kinds of omissions that you had, here's what you find. You find nuance, like the patient is able to walk on flat levels and walk at a moderate pace for 1 hour without abnormal shortness. You have a lot of promptly sort of stuff that's an elaboration or a nuance on something. You have temporal and logical context. The tachycardia in this case occurred far removed from the time of the infarction. In other words, this tachycardia happened long after this other heart problem, the heart attack. The second bullet here is kind of interesting. The patient was an airline pilot, and one doctor was communicating to the other, you know what, I don't really think we should recertify him to fly without this procedure. I have a feeling... don't recertify patient to fly without this procedure is not a checkbox that it's easy to put into these medical records. So we were trying to be appropriately conservative, but not crazily conservative in our analysis. The dictating physician's thought process. These things, computerized patient order entry, or CPOE, there are systems that now do a very good job of keeping track of allowing physicians to say, I ordered this, you know, as a medication or something. But it doesn't do a very good job of capturing, you know, I'm recommending this medication because blah, blah, blah. Right? I think that, you know, what the symptoms I'm seeing are suggestive of. There's a lot of stuff about the clinician's thought process. Those were categories. In short, the stuff that once we, you know, were very conservative about this and gave it as much credit as we could, the things that you couldn't fit in were exactly the things that make a narrative a narrative. The temporal context, the logical reasoning and connections between things, the detailed nuance that can only be expressed through natural language. So the bottom line here is if you lose the language, you lose the story. Second part of this argument. There's another reason the language of the clinical narrative is a big deal, and that has to do with what you can learn from clinical records if you're analyzing them in the aggregate and on a large scale. So people may be familiar with this progression from data to information to knowledge and ultimately wisdom, where wisdom is the ability to make good choices based on the data and the information and the knowledge. I don't actually have a lot to say about wisdom right now. But I do have something to say about data and information and knowledge. The way that you discover things in clinical contexts, this is actually, we were talking about this with folks yesterday, you could actually cast the Bayesian inference model in this picture also. This is like all of scientific discovery if you look at it the right way. You start with a set of priors and then you update. Sorry, that was just an aside for my techie friends in the room. What you do is you take the data, the raw data, and then you take your knowledge about categories in the world. I know there are things that are diagnoses. I know some of those diagnoses are cancers. Or I know that there are people, and I know that the people have ages. Whatever the structuring information is, and you apply that to the raw data in order to extract information. And then you look at the patterns in aggregate for information, and that gives you new knowledge, which is shown up in green here. Right? So, you know, I see that this drug tends to lead to this outcome with this symptom or, you know, this a syndrome or disease. I can now, if I see that regularly enough, that becomes a part of our knowledge base. And here's the crucial part. Here's the crucial part where there's feedback. Now we take that knowledge and we use it to inform our new analysis of the data, because we have new knowledge and new categories. And then we use that to extract information according to updated criteria. New classifications of diseases, new groups of symptoms that we've all of a sudden realized are actually related to each other. And so forth. So, and the cycle goes on. But here's the problem. If what she's doing over there on the left is entering information, not data. If she's using a pull-down list that captures our current knowledge and categories, then this cycle never happens. You break the cycle. Without the original data, right, because if it never gets created, you can never take your new knowledge and go back to the old data and reanalyze it in light of new knowledge. Because the data's not there. They use the existing categories. And you might say, well, it'd be great. Well, just update those things so they keep up with medical knowledge. Anybody in here trying to keep up with medical knowledge? How many journal articles are you reading? Or how many journal articles are you not reading every day? So I'm going to give a concrete example here. In the late 80s, early 90s, a higher resolution CT scanner was introduced, new piece of medical equipment. And so radiologists who were looking at images started discovering a phenomenon that had not happened before. So an opacity is sort of like I'm not a doctor, I'll just, you know, think of something, opaque means not transparent. You can see nodules in the lung, and there are some that are transparent, meaning you can see through them. There are some that are solid, you can't see through them. And with the introduction of this piece of equipment, there is now a kind of opacity that hadn't existed before, which they called ground glass opacity. They started calling it, had the quality of ground glass. It was semi-opaque. People started using that term in 1991-ish. There's a journal citation down at the bottom here from 1993, right, where they're talking about it in the title of the in the title of the article. I dug around. The first hint that I could find of this in any of the medical ontologies was when it was introduced in Medtra in 2001. So what if these people, instead of dictating, had been doing a pull-down list about what they were seeing in the images they were looking at? Well, then they wouldn't have been saying, wow, that looks a lot like ground glass. Would they have taken the time to fill in a text box and done that? I don't know. Once we have a new category, and it turns out to be significant. By the way, it's clinically very significant. There's a study, I haven't cited it here, where the solid nodules predict lung cancer with some probability, the non-solid ones another, and when it's semi-solid like this, much higher probability. But you couldn't go back and look at the last 10 years of data in order to look at the relationship between ground glass opacities and other phenomena and characteristics of the patients, because you wouldn't have had the language that said ground glass opacities. So this presents us with a dilemma. On the one hand, as a computer scientist, I like the people who do databases and predictive analytics. I do some of that. I don't do databases, but I mean, I do some of this stuff myself. You want to count things and do these analyses. We love big data. We want to do the analytics and find things out. And you can't do that if you haven't standardized, normalized, made things come out the same way. But there's a problem that people are not paying attention to, right? If you want that, and this kind of electronic medical record concept is the way of getting there, which seems to be where a lot of the momentum is, they threaten to disrupt or destroy the natural form of communication using clinical language that exists in today's records. Never mind the fact that doctors seem to hate having their faces down in these things rather than faces up talking to the patients. So I've created a dilemma here. And now I'm done. I go away. No, I mean, the point of this is to make an argument. The argument that I'm making now that I've set this up is that natural language processing as a form of technology offers a way out of the dilemma. Who here knows what natural language processing is? A lot of people. Okay. For the... Very excellent researcher goes, I don't really know what it is. So natural language processing is the automatic processing of natural language, i.e. human language, by computers in order to do useful things with it. When you use Google Translate, there's natural language processing under there. When Watson was answering questions on Jeopardy, there's natural language processing under there. When you're talking to Siri, whether or not you can get it to do what you want it to, it's doing natural language processing in there. Not just speech recognition, but doing stuff with the words and phrases and analysis and so forth, right? This field has been around for a long time. And it offers a potential solution. Now, in here, I'm going to focus on the problem of coding, because that's central in the revenue cycle. But I'm going to broaden this out a little bit toward the end to try to say this is a more general statement that I'm making. So let's go back to the earlier picture, right? How do doctors document and then get paid on the basis of that documentation? Well, they dictate, the dictation gets transcribed, or sometimes they type it, sometimes they use automatic speech recognition and they correct the errors themselves. This produces text, and then you have armies of human coders who are turning that thing. In the example I'll give here, it's a procedure codes and ICD codes. There are other kinds of codes and other kinds of things, but I'm going to focus on these for these examples. This is a very archaic, labor-intensive way of doing things, by the way. And by the way, there's a real shortage of the people who are qualified and know how to do this, and it's going to get a lot worse because the coding systems are about to change within the next, well... depending on when you actually expect it to happen, based on what the government has to say, within the next couple of years, so that the number of codes that they have to deal with is going to go from 18,000 on the diagnosis side to an order of magnitude higher. there are a lot of people thinking of retiring. There are people who are worried about this problem. They're not going to be able to do it as well. It's screaming out for some kind of automation. Actually, back in 1999, it was screaming out for some automation, and we started doing some stuff with it. And I'm sorry, then those things go to the billing, and that goes to the payers. But notice, what they've done is coded clinical records. Social scientists will know what coding is. Natural language processing people call this annotation. You're adding useful metadata to natural language text. So there's a different model. There's a different model in which, instead of going to human coders first, it goes to a natural language processing engine of some kind, which extracts the useful information, proposes codes, and then through some mechanism, based on how confident or not confident it is, it either sends those things directly downstream to whatever the application is, let's say a billing system, or it goes through a human review phase because machines make mistakes and you don't want to code incorrectly because that can cost you money or put you in jail, literally. So I want to give you, take a second and give you just a little bit of the flavor of what the natural language processing systems do with this respect. And I'm not presenting any particular NLP system. This is the kinds of steps that any such system goes through, just to give people a flavor of it. One of the first things that you have to do is you need to take the record and you need to break it up into relevant pieces or regions. So, you know, that part is the history and physical, history of present illness, medical history, past surgical history, and so forth. I've indicated that by different colors. This can be very easy, especially if you have a template structured kind of record. It can also be really hard. Like, cardiologists seem to like writing letters to each other. They big, long letters, which are very non-differentiated. And so you have to use, for example, statistical natural language processing techniques to model the structure of the information to automatically segment this thing into different pieces. And it's kind of cool because there's other technology outside healthcare where you're doing things like segmenting conversations. Like here's a news show you're watching. Can we automatically find the breaks where they went from one story to the other? Very, very similar concept. A lot of concepts from traditional natural language processing being applied in this domain. So the next thing that you need to do, I'm just pulling out some of these regions here so that we can focus on them. The next thing you need to do is there's another kind of region or span of text you need to pay a lot of attention to, and that's places where something was negated or stated in an equivocal way. He denies any chest pain. That's very, you don't want to code chest pain when, chest pain. I see chest pain. I guess there's chest pain there. Has not had any problems as far as his day-to-day work. You know, the sort of negation. You also have equivocation. Right? This is suggestive of or whatever. You need to identify that because there's a difference between mentioning something and saying that it is present. Although that depends on the coding. If you're doing one kind of coding, you get credit just for asking the question. Like if you're doing an evaluation and management visit, you go to the doctor's office. If the doctor checked about a symptom or a problem and you don't have it, that nonetheless is relevant in a way that is not in the procedure world. This is a crazy world with all sorts of different, the inpatient and outpatient and everything else. Lots of different standards that you have to apply. It's showing up a little bit at least. In yellow, what I've shown here is identifying diagnostically relevant little chunks of information. You need to find a way to do that. There are lots of different ways to do that. I want to mention two pieces that are, I'm going to highlight because they give you a flavor of the kinds of things that natural language processing people do. One is, actually, morphology is the analysis of how words are built. So morphology is how bodies are built. And in another domain, it's how words are built in linguistics. So for example, pains with an S is built out of pain and a plural marker, the S at the end. And that matters in some contexts. In others, it doesn't. Pains versus pain may matter in one kind of context. It may not matter in a different context. If you're doing ICD-9 coding, there's no difference between headache and headaches, but there is a difference between cyst and cysts. So there's a lot of domain knowledge, actually, that goes into this, not just the linguistic knowledge that you need to do. Another thing that you have to do, people may have heard, parsing. If you don't know what that is, some of you may be old enough to remember diagramming sentences when you were a kid, breaking the sentences up into their relevant pieces of structure. So that, for example, the 57-year-old female here, right, who's been having chest pains, 57-year-old female is a relevant chunk. right? Located substernally is a relevant chunk. You can also have analyses that say, 57-year-old modifies female. That's part of what glues this chunk together. And there are automatic methods for doing these things that can and have been adapted to clinical domains. Once you've done that sort of thing, you then take the results of that and do what is often referred to as information extraction, which is taking the structure that you've identified linguistically and pulling it out and using it to fill slots in some kind of representation. That's what information extraction is. Right, I have. So this is the database filling-ish sort of thing. Another way of looking at this is this is. And by the way, this is not a complete representation by any means. It just gives you the flavor. These are representations of basic clinical diagnostic facts. You need to know whether the fact that's being given is about the patient's history or about the patient's current presenting problem, or whether it's about the family history, or in the context of saying I'm trying to rule out this problem. So that column there, that field in the record for in computer science terminology, is all about those distinctions. Here on the right, you have the diagnosis or problem. So fibrillation is a kind of problem. And then you have this anatomy and modifier thing is one way of representing the idea that you have to locate this within the anatomy, and often there are modifiers. It happened in the hand. Oh, it's the left hand. That kind of information. So you can think of each row in this thing as an index card that rolls up a structured chunk of information that is considered to be some sort of clinical fact that's relevant. This is a form of abstraction of information. You also do things with this, recognizing allergies, for example, or medications. Right, that business of take such and such a drug one time daily has structure to it. You have the drug, you have the number of times, you have the unit of time, one time daily versus one time weekly, and so forth. There's structure here, and this is the stage where you go from the unstructured language to the structured representations, and from there, you can go downstream to some other kind of rolled up coding system. In this case, I'm showing you diagnosis codes. Take those clinical facts, map them to something. It could be mapping into a medical ontology of some kind. It could be mapping into SNOMED, right? Mapping into some standardized representation, and then using that according to the downstream purpose. So, for example, if you're doing coding for billing, then what you're most concerned about is the primary diagnosis, which is what justifies the procedure. Although you also want to know about other stuff, and there's a lot of logic in there. Domain-specific knowledge that generic NLP people don't know a lot about. So, for example, how to distinguish a pertinent diagnosis from an incidental diagnosis. You know, if the guy came in with a headache and you found a fracture in his left elbow, you can't really, you actually have to distinguish those things in terms of the diagnosis for purposes of billing payment and so forth. On the other hand, for clinical purposes, these are all clinical facts. They're part of the information about the patient. What you want to do is get from the language to the structure. Why? Because the structure is the stuff you can put in your databases, put in your analytics. You can build a search engine that doesn't just search for words. It searches for this kind of problem in a negated context. I'm looking for cases where the patient does not have pneumonia. Not just the doctor didn't mention pneumonia, but somebody explicitly said, no evidence of pneumonia, in one of the zillion different ways you can negate and say no evidence of. Why do you do that? So now you can do analytics. Now you can pull for clinical trials. I need somebody who doesn't have pneumonia but has this other problem. So just to show you a little bit of what that looks like when you put it in a clinical setting, on the left here, you have the language of the record, and the stuff on the right is extracted information. In this case, there's a procedure code repairing superficial wounds, and the open wound of the scalp, a simple open wound of the scalp. If it were complex, it would be 873.1 instead of 0.0. And then these are the sorts of things that you can now put in front of a coder, so that instead of looking at a bunch of stuff on paper and trying to look stuff up in books, her job now becomes auditing the natural language processing engine's output. That's a very different thing to do. And it streamlines the process quite a bit. and it's a way of doing quality control. Sometimes you can simply bypass that process, as I said, and do things fully automatically, and I can tell you about percentages of that if people are interested. Here's another example. This is evaluation and management. So if you go to a clinician for a visit, and they ask you, does your back hurt? How are you feeling today? And so forth. They get credit for the different things that they ask and the systems they look at. It's a 5-level coding system, where 5 is they get paid the most and 1 is they get paid the least. This is the one where it's most risky and where people have gotten, like, fined, institutions have gotten fined millions upon millions of dollars. There's a case a number of years ago where it turned out that a particular institution, hospital system, they had a form where they simply circled 1 through 5. That's what the doctor did to indicate the level, and the form didn't have 1, 2, or 3 on it. Not good. It also doesn't give you the information that's justifying why it was done. And how useful is that if you're trying to build clinical records to analyze and mine and aggregate information for all of these downstream applications? One more, which is kind of cool. This is a vascular interventional radiology interface for coding that, where the analysis, this is a very complicated thing. This is where catheters, you have to know where they went into the body and which vessels they went through. It's a very complicated narrative of its own with a lot of structure. But you can use natural language processing to analyze the clinical dictation of all of this stuff in order to build the picture of what happened. And each one of those things potentially is an event with a code associated with it. And you can take that and translate it into a picture that is drawn on the fly based on the dictation. So the stuff in red, if you can see it here, are the places where the dictation supports that the catheter went through there. The gold here is a place where there's a gap. If I recall correctly, this picture doesn't show it very well, but you can have situations where if you look in the anatomy, you see red, gold, red. And you know what that tells you? That tells you that either the doctor left out part of the dictation and didn't document it completely, or the natural language processing missed it, that there's a gap. And so there's a whole process of clinical documentation improvement that you can do when you have these methods as well. What does it take to do this? It really takes 3 things. Number 1, it takes natural language processing. And natural language processing is intimately tied to large data and machine learning. This is a fact that doesn't seem to have hit healthcare. There are a lot of people who are using 1980s-style methods of natural language processing in a healthcare setting. And the argument that I make, the embedded circles that you see up there, sorry for those of you who are sticklers. The one in the innermost one is rule-based methods. That's the kind of stuff that we started, when I started going to school for this stuff, this is what we were doing. Then the next circle is using data to improve your rule-based methods. For example, instead of mining an expert's head for rules, you actually have them look at data in order to validate their rules or come up with new rules. The interaction between data and knowledge on a large scale was a big improvement in the field once we started having data in the field. And then the outermost circle is machine learning. And the reason that I'm taking the time to point this out is that these are not exclusive of each other. It's not like we have medical expertise and rules, and over here we do machine learning and stuff. That battle was fought in the natural language processing community in the 1990s. And the picture that you see up there is what resulted. Okay. So the second thing that you need is data. You need clinical data in order to do this. Ideally coded clinical data, because that's how you learn to relate the language to the codes. Look at how humans code and try to predict what a human would have done when they were coding the same information. That's called supervised machine learning. As it happens, remember all those coders I told you about who are sitting in back offices of hospitals or whatever coding? They think that they're solving a business purpose, but from the perspective of people in our community, I'm pointing to some of the people over here, they're creating training data for us. They are throwing off training data while they are in the process of solving this business purpose, in much the same way that every time the United Nations releases a new version of its proceedings in multiple languages, they're providing training data for Google Translate. They thought they were doing it for a different reason, but Google knows why. It was to give me training data. right? And the third thing that you need is subject matter expertise. Not just the people who create that data, but the experts who provide the knowledge that goes into this system. You can't simply throw natural language processing at this. I describe this as the three-legged stool. If you're missing any one of these three things, these approaches can't work. You're not going to do well on this problem. I want to mention one more thing. I mentioned sort of the idea of searching. This is the sort of thing that you can do once you have annotated data. You've extracted allergies and conditions and demographics and all of that other stuff. There's a whole bunch of stuff that you can do with that now. You can take all the clinical records for an organization and go through. I'll skip to the next one for a second. See G there, provider profiling. You can look for the MDs who are doing things or not doing things. And this is much better than just analyzing claims data because you have the full record. You have all the information, and you can do a search that includes concepts like, you know, diagnoses, SNOMED concepts, ICD codes, CPT codes, whatever, or terminology, or both together. Call this a faceted search. You can improve the revenue cycle. This is, you know, specialist referral rates outside of the physician group. So which of my doctors are actually referring patients out to, you know, out to other doctor groups? I mentioned clinical trials. That's A there, right? We're looking for people with no history of lung cancer, but they do have a history of this. They're within this age range and so forth. These are the sorts of things that people want to use EHRs for. These are also the sorts of things that if you structure the record automatically with natural language processing, you get a lot of that value. So, to close, we can get where we need to go with electronic health records without giving up the language. That's the message. The reason I am here at South by Southwest, other than because it's really fun, is because I don't think people are aware of that. I think everybody just sees these EMRs and is like, oh, I guess that's what we're doing. Oh, we hate this. Oh, yeah, but okay, well, which one are we going to choose? Right? But there's an alternative. It's already being used in the coding context. And it provides a greater window of opportunity than people realize. This is just a visual way of doing this, of saying this. So you want to let the physicians do what they do well on the left here. On the right, you've got knowledge sources, and you want to continuously update those knowledge sources in that virtuous cycle that I talked about before. And then you want to let the NLP engine, informed by all of the best knowledge and data, give you that standardized, interoperable, available information that you need. So I don't know how many of you watched Heroes, the TV series a while back, but I figured I'd end on a South by Southwesty optimistic note. The tagline in that series in the first season was "Save the cheerleader, save the world." And so I'm going to adapt that in this context because every individual is a world. To the family, to the friends, every individual is a world in that sense. And so you save the narrative. You save the world. Thank you. I believe there's time for questions, and it's being recorded, so if you wouldn't mind using the mic for questions, that's probably a good thing.
Great talk. Scott Mays from Health Leaders Media, but you said something early about quality and how the existing EMRs were doing a good job of capturing quality measurements. Can you elaborate on that a little bit?
I said they were or were not.
I thought you said that they were.
I'm not sure if I did.
Okay. I'll have to go back. I recorded it. But
yeah. Quality measurements like PQRI and that sort of thing can be very complex, actually.
Right. Some of them are fairly simple.
And some of them are fairly simple.
Okay.
So my message here is not that you should do away with discrete data.
Right.
There's a place for checkboxes. There is absolutely a place for all of that stuff. The message here is that you don't want to use that in such a way that you are losing the rest of the information. And people don't seem to realize, oh wow, this happens to be a physician quality reporting measure. That's what this PQRI thing is about. And boy, the only way to figure it out is to have humans take a sample and audit and look at these records and read these things. I have no idea how we can do this. And how do we do this in these EMRs? The natural language processing can help.
Right, because I'm still trying to visualize how it's going to work when doctors trying to do a narrative, but they're also trying to check these boxes off. I'm just
my personal view: the doctor shouldn't be checking the boxes while they're trying to do a narrative. I think that there are ways to engineer the ergonomics of a system. The problem is such that it balances these things. The problem is nobody's trying to.
So nobody's built a prototype of this yet.
There's a lot of things that you can do. There are dictation. There are ways of dictating and pulling things out. Structuring the dictation in particular ways and so forth. There are a lot of things you can do. The problem is we have this train. We have this freight train moving. And so nobody's thinking about it. So if nothing else, my goal here today is to say, think about it. Thank you.
I'm Heidi Shalev. I work with Austin Regional Clinic here in town, and we are implementing EMRs. I know we also have dictation systems where the physicians can talk into them, and we're tying that into the EMR. We also have a lot of non-native English speakers, and I was wondering how natural language processing does with non-native English language speakers in understanding the nuances of their language and tying it in.
So let's distinguish speech recognition from natural language processing.
Right, and I'm not meaning that the dictation systems do that, but I was saying...
Yeah, I just want to make sure.
Yes.
So the question is not how do you actually transcribe language from people who speak differently, which is a different set of problems. The issue is... I have a question for you. Is there evidence that non-native speakers in the medical context, assuming that you're actually transcribing the words all correctly, are in fact using medical language differently than other people are?
No, there's not. What I was wondering how NLP handles it for simple things when they switch adjectives. So they put the adjective after the noun or before the noun or differently than we do it in English. Does NLP, are they still able to chunk those bits of pieces of information together?
So this is one of these, the key word here in the business is robustness. If you write a rule that says a sentence is made of a noun phrase followed by a verb phrase, and then somebody gives you a sentence that's not built like that, if your system gives you a blue screen of death, you know something's wrong. The system's not robust. Right? So natural language processing systems in their current generation, where you take advantage of machine learning and so forth, or at least being data-driven, this is a place where the role of the data is really important. Because there, what you want to do is see as much data flowing through the system so that even if you are taking a data plus rules approach, not a statistical approach, you're capturing the fact that there's a lot of variation. You look at a quarter of a billion medical records, you see that there are lots and lots of different ways of saying things. So you need to build a system that is not prescriptive about this is how you have to build a sentence, because the fact of the matter is you can't get people to do that. And I have to say, even just among English speakers, the variation is astonishing. So you have to deal with it. You need to build your system in a robust way. Thank you.
Catherine Krega with Diversity Interactive, and I'm researching global engineering teams and R&D teams, and I just wanted to comment on that because there is a lot of research that started with NASA basically looking at verbal probability statements and how people use those and across cultures. The International Accounting Standards Board has done a lot of research with folks that have worked together for 20 years who are all trained in U.S. schools and U.S. textbooks. They use verbal probability statements very differently. So like...
Can you give an example?
Well, for example, in an annual report, the auditor has to certify the report as being almost certain that the report is true. So they did some research and looked around the world and said, you know, ask the Malaysians and the other folks, what percentage is almost certain, right?
Yeah, and people are terrible.
No, and the Malaysians said 80%. The Chinese said 70 to 80%. Americans say 96%. So even though they're all in the same industry, they've all supposedly been socialized by the same, you know, curricula, they do use these verbal probability statements differently.
Yep.
There's one that I'm aware of from a radiation tool supplier that also supplies in the semiconductor industry, and that's how I came across them. There was some kind of measure of asking the patient how much pain they have or how frequently they have it, and they use that to set the radiation dials. So they did a lot of research. There's also, and as you know, women in, for example, in the Middle East, when they're asked to rate their pain in pregnancy, they say it's a 2.
They'll downplay it.
Yeah. They say it's not very painful.
And I can tell you when my wife and I were in the hospital and, you know, she was in labor, she was not going to downplay it as a 2.
Yeah, so that's very interesting to me. There's also a lot of research on how people who grew up in... using inductive reasoning in their textbooks versus deductive reasoning, how they structure sentences, and how those are translated. So that's very interesting to me, this issue that when, because I'm sort of a global citizen and I study this, when I go to a doctor who has a different kind of maybe syntax, or, you know, I kind of am interpreting everything that they say from that, from my knowledge of how they're probably going to structure things, whereas maybe the average patient can't do that. And so I that's why I came actually today, just to learn more about that too.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Hi, I'm Amit Malhotra. I work for the advisory board and I have two questions. One is, I wanted your opinion on how, you know, as a follow on to the question about quality, how do you see the role of registries and EMRs sort of playing at the physician interface? So this, the physicians are dictating, their EMRs, which tend to capture the more like an EHR overall health record, but then there are also these quality initiatives where people are trying to capture quality information. Is that a different system? Is it, you know, I don't know if you've thought about it or...
So you're taking me out, and it's not bad, but you're taking me outside my comfort zone.
Okay.
Because my focus has been on the sort of the inside of the technology. There are a whole, I used to be in a singing group in college, and we used to say is we'll take requests, and if we don't know it, we promise not to sing it. So I hesitate to give any kind of authoritative answer. There's a whole space of things. There's health information exchanges. There's data warehousing. There's an enormous amount of, I guess I don't want to use the word ancillary. I think of it more as downstream from all of this. And the for me at least, it's about where does the information come from? And how are we getting into the system and not blocking things upstream that we want to make it to those downstream places? Unfortunately, I don't feel like I can answer the specifics.
Right. And the other piece is, any thoughts you have on IBM Watson project and how that plays into the work you guys are doing?
Yeah, you know, Watson's getting a lot of, people are talking about it a lot. A number of us here know people who've worked on the Watson project. David Ferrucci was the keynote speaker at... the guy who headed the project was the keynote speaker at one of our big conferences recently. We all like it a lot. But we don't necessarily like what's been made of it. There is a great deal of misunderstanding out there. In fact, Jason Baldridge and Lillian Lee right here gave something this morning, and you should go look at their slides and listen to the recording of their talk. Because what they were talking about was the hype cycle. The good news with Watson is there's a set of approaches that people have been following that its success has now kind of defined as a kind of standard. Not the right thing for every problem, but a kind of standard. It is a big data approach that uses a significant amount of human knowledge. Right? It's not just that it read anthropomorphizing, you know, all of Wikipedia. It also had WordNet and other lexical databases and lists of movies. And it combines the data and the knowledge. It had rules that it followed. But crucially, it also used multiple paths of trying to solve the problem and then combined the results at the end. There's a set of criteria that they used very, very effectively. That's the good news, because that's the way you want to solve the problem. The bad news is that people kind of like, oh, Watson, you get one of two possibilities, either Watson, no big deal, or wow, Watson is artificial intelligence, the problem is solved, and when is Skynet coming? I think that Watson took advantage of a lot of specifics of the problem, the way that things are phrased in those questions. I think it took advantage of the fact that you had domains of knowledge and it knew something about those. I think it was a really interesting success, and I think that we need to be careful not to overinterpret it, is the sort of thing. But it's been great for the field, because I used to say, oh, I do natural language processing, and people say, well, what's that? And I was like, well, you ever use Google Translate? And, well, no. But, you know, we had, what, 11 million people watching Watson? It's like, yeah, those are my people. I like that kind of work. That's the kind of stuff I do. So that's one of the nice things about it. And here comes somebody else who knows a lot about this topic.
No, I'm not going to correct you.
Hi, I'm Mark Dredzi from Johns Hopkins. So I really like your explanation of this tension between structured and unstructured data. And the problem is once we put structure, once we force doctors to use structured data, we lose all the nuance of the unstructured data, the clinical text. So from a practical perspective, how do you convince, and what you really need to do is convince them that, oh, if you just wrote out the text, if you did that enough, then I could really help you. But until you start doing that, I can't really, you can't really build any technology for it. And especially in the context of, let's say, at Hopkins, where we're spending a number, I don't want to say how much we're spending, because no one here will believe me, but we're spending a lot of money on new medical system, a new EHR system. And no one in that effort, I shouldn't say no one, but almost no one in that effort really thinks about NLP and how it's going to play a role. And so you talk about a freight train. This is a lot bigger than a freight train, at least Hopkins. So how do you convince anyone that NLP has a role here and that they should change what they're doing based on it?
So I mentioned that I do stuff in a consulting context out of academia with this company I helped start with CodeWright. The guy who had the vision of this company told us, there were four of us initially. There was two language guys and a very good coder and a guy who knew how to glue systems together. And the guy who started it up and kind of recruited us and said, hey, we should do this, two things that you need to know. One is you can't get doctors to change what they're doing, and number two, you can't get them to pay more even if it's better. So you need to think about being constrained in that framework. But one of the things that you can do is show the bottom line. That is actually surprisingly effective. There is an entire sub-discipline within this domain called CDI, Clinical Documentation Improvement, and the people who do the coding stuff and the documentation specialists are desperately trying to improve the documentation process. This can help, because here's one of the things that you can do. You can do an automatic analysis of a physician's set of records in a system and say, you know what? According to our system, which did this automatically, you failed to document blah, blah, blah this amount of the time. This lost you that much money. You can do things once you've aggregated the data that says, here is the bell curve of your practice or lots of practices that are similar to yours. This is where you are. Is that a good idea? You can actually, people south and southwest, go south by southwest, you're throwing around ROI, return on investment. Really, what and WIFM, what's in it for me? These terms actually have meaning when it comes to trying to convince people to change stuff. You have to convince them that it makes sense for them. But the don't make them change what they're doing is still an important guideline. If you can find, the goal here is if you can find a way to let clinicians do what they want to do, because not doing it is driving a lot of them out of medicine. Then we have a chance to kind of save the system. And if you can streamline it and save money at the same time, I mean, coding is a billions of dollar a year industry. Getting the codes wrong costs people a lot of money. Not being able to extract and abstract information in order to figure out what the outcomes are like. These are big ticket items. This is why everybody cares about this so much. So you have to go to where it hurts. You have to go to where what they care about. And saying, oh, this is cool new technology is not going to do it. Much though I would love it to. I've tried. Anybody else, or shall we call it an afternoon? Okay, I think we're good. Thank you so much.